The tide of war was turning. Popov could feel it in the humour and spirit of Londoners. The great counterattack against occupied Europe was in sight. Everyone, the Germans included, knew the invasion was coming. Again he lobbied his spymasters to recruit Johnny Jepsen, pointing out that once his friend realized that Germany was going to lose the war, he would be only too willing to reinsure himself with the victors by telling them all he could. Popov offered to make the approach himself on his next visit to Lisbon. Johnny has never been pro-Nazi, he insisted, and had access to high-grade information, including full details of the personnel of the Abwehr and its agents in many countries. Wilson had qualms about Jebsen's suspect financial activities. Johnny is always carrying out various more or less irregular deals, as well as acting as an agent of the Abwehr. But he was tempted by the prospects of recruiting an amoral opportunist and not particularly Nazi informant within the Abwehr at this critical juncture. Wilson toyed with getting Popov to offer a promise to arrange for Johnny to receive favourable treatment, providing that Johnny has something worthwhile to sell to the British. Jepsen had recruited Popov. Now Popov might recruit Jepsen. The Germans regard their personal friendship as an essential part of the setup, Wilson observed, and if Jepsen really was as anti-Nazi as Popov said, then he might make a useful double agent himself. We must seek to take advantage of Jepsen's outlook. As the winter of 1942 closed in, Popov described himself as the shabbiest and coldest man in London, a statement that was demonstrably untrue. He amused himself by demanding additional luxuries and wrote to Colonel Freckles Wren of MI6 in New York, "My heart is in very bad condition. My doctor, who is my biggest friend, says it is too much alcohol, tobacco, and sin. The only remedy which I found efficient until now was milk and chocolates. Please send $100 worth of any kind of chocolate you can think of. I don't mind what they are. I am taking them as medicine. Please send me at the same time $100 of nylons in 9, 9½, and 10. Don't think I'm promiscuous." Wren did not swallow Popov's claim of a medical chocolate emergency. The chocolates are intended to delight the interiors of those same exteriors which he wishes to decorate with stockings. But it was a measure of Popov's status that he could instruct the British Secret Services to buy nylons for him, and they grudgingly obliged. "We have done our best to carry out Tricycle's wishes with regard to comforts for his lovelies, but I have a strong feeling that this kind of business should now stop. It is legitimate for an agent working abroad to supply douceur if it is necessary to do so in the interests of the state at war. I cannot see how that principle can apply to Tricycle. Do you think it would be possible to bring home to Tricycle the fact that his country and we have a right to his unselfish duty?" Tar Robertson was indulgent, arguing that Tricycle has the Balkan outlook that all positions of influence can be turned to personal advantage. To make matters worse, Popov's American creditors discovered that he worked for the British government in some capacity, and the Keystone Debt Collection Agency began demanding payment of his unpaid bills through diplomatic channels. "The one thing that does strike me as urgent is that we should stop the Debt Collection Agency trying to dun Tricycle further through the British Ministry of Information," wrote Tarr. Trivett's tested seeds finally got what it was owed, unaware that it had successfully extracted money from British intelligence. At a meeting with Wilson in February, Popov announced his desire to do something more active in the way of outwitting the Germans, and was told there was certainly no intention of letting his case vegetate. Popov asked to be parachuted into Yugoslavia to join the Chetnik partisans, insisting he was ready to take almost any risks to achieve anything that would be really useful. The request was turned down. Popov was too valuable to be risked, but his demands and complaints, his restlessness and sexual shenanigans, his white silk shirts with soft collars and fancy ties, were starting to try even Wilson's vast reserves of tolerance. "Tricycle is continuing to make an infernal nuisance of himself." So it was agreed to send him back to Portugal. "Every double-cross agent is inclined to be vain, moody, and introspective," wrote Masterman. but these volatile personalities were proving ever harder to handle. One of the most important members of the team had gotten himself arrested. Another was in the throes of a spectacular marital bust-up, and a third was demanding women, chocolates, and silk shirts, while living the life of a pampered prince. Even Elvira Chaudoir was asking for more money and flirting with MI6. The constant need to monitor, cajole, flatter, and sustain these difficult people was taking a toll. However, the effort, expense, and frustration would all be worthwhile if the double-cross spies managed to deceive the Germans into making some large and disastrous mistake. At the Casablanca Conference in January 1943, the Allies agreed that a cross-channel invasion could not be undertaken before the spring of 1944. The main thrust for 1943 would be into Italy via Sicily, while Stalin's Red Army continued the epic battle in the east. The Germans knew that an invasion of France was only a matter of time, and were already laying plans to reinforce the Atlantic Wall, with millions of tons of cement and steel, using slave labour. They could not know that the Allies had decided to focus elsewhere in 1943, and therein lay an opportunity. A deception plan, codenamed Cockade, was drawn up by the London Controlling Section to mount bogus threats to Norway and northern France, in the hope of drawing off German troops from the Mediterranean and the Eastern Front, or at least pinning down those in northern Europe. In early September, a mock invasion fleet would set sail from Kent and Hampshire, apparently heading for Calais, to draw the Luftwaffe into battle over the Channel. Another fake invasion force, this time American, would threaten Brittany, while a third fake force would threaten Norway. The central plank of the deception was to be nailed down by planting false information through the double agents. Cockade was not quite the grand roll of the dice envisaged by Masterman, but it was the most ambitious gamble so far. The B-1A team sprang into action. Von Kasthoff's messages to Popov indicated that invasion questions are no doubt what the enemy is chiefly interested in. Therefore, it ought to be supplied with a lot of items from which it is possible to draw all sorts of inferences about our future intentions. Popov was in his best mood, and looking forward to seeing Jebsen again. He should be back here in time to put over some really effective misinformation when invasion of the continent becomes imminent, wrote Wilson. In July, Popov flew to Lisbon once more, leaving MI5 to pay his overdue rent, carrying a briefcase full of hints indicating that an invasion of France was at hand. His tailor had told him senior officers were ordering new battle dress, hospitals were preparing beds, and electrically propelled canoes were being manufactured in large numbers. He told von Kasthoff he had taken his girlfriends to different South Coast towns on various weekends, and in Southampton he had spotted that shelters were being prepared for a retaliatory air attack, indicating that the port would be active as a supply base for the invading army. Popov's sub-agents, Gelatin and Balloon, added corroborative details, while Mutt and Jeff, the two Norwegians, reported that Norway was under threat of attack from Scotland. Bronx relayed invasion gossip picked up from politicians, journalists and others, including a conversation with an invented Harley Street surgeon called Nielsen, who told her of hospital arrangements for an invasion in autumn. On July 11th, she wrote, France to be attacked in September. Increased production of invasion badges. Good harvest and increase in pig farming. The reply congratulated her. Pleased with work. Exact details on invasion will pay expenses of travel for this. The Garbo Network reported concentrations of troops in Wales and Scotland, while Puyol himself claimed to have seen 7 divisions near Brighton, though he was careful to point out that this might be just an exercise. His sub-agent spotted assault craft gathering in the Channel ports, military camps near Southampton, and torpedo boats massing in Dover. On Robertson's orders, even Flight Lieutenant Walker's pigeons were enrolled into the deception. For some time, British intelligence had been dropping homing pigeons into occupied France, carrying questionnaires about German defences, in the hope that at least some of them will fall into the hands of people who are supporters of the Allied cause, who were urged to fill out the forms and release the birds to fly back across the Channel. The pigeons were dropped by parachute in cardboard containers, each with a small bag of corn. I gather some satisfactory results have been obtained from the answers to these questionnaires, wrote Robertson, but some fall into the hands of the enemy. Any method of seeking the truth can be used to plant a lie. It occurs to me that this is a possible means of putting deception over to the enemy by the careful framing of the questionnaires, as presumably the Germans must, if they capture some of these birds, take notice of the kind of question being asked. Robertson gave orders that the questionnaire carried by pigeons dropped in the Pas-de-Calais and West Coast areas should convey the impression that we are very keen on getting detailed intelligence about these areas in beach and coast defences, airfields, focal points on road and rail communications, detailed locations of formation headquarters and units, bridges, ports, and installations for demolition, etc. The Germans would read this and assume an imminent invasion. Walker prepared his flock, and in August more than 1,000 homing pigeons, each carrying a list of questions deliberately framed to suggest a looming attack, were dropped in a flapping deluge on Calais and Brittany. The mere fact of increasing the number of pigeons used has a certain deceptive value, Robertson gleefully reported. Finally, the day of the dummy invasion arrived. On September 8th, Agent Garbo reported that troops had been confined to barracks and assault craft were gathering. A mock invasion flotilla of some 30 ships headed for France, preceded by minesweepers. With information coming in from all sides, the Germans surely could not fail to think that a huge invasion was taking place. But that is exactly what happened. In response to the great charade, the Germans did nothing at all. The shore batteries did not open up, the Luftwaffe did not take to the air, and the High Command did not redeploy troops from places where they were needed. As one British officer wryly remarked, it was an inspiring sight to see everybody doing his stuff to perfection, except, unfortunately, the Germans. The only indication that they even noticed the elaborate performance put on for their benefit came when a German coast artillery subaltern on the far shore was overheard calling his captain on the radio to ask if anybody knew what all this fuss was about. About 10 miles off Boulogne, the bogus invasion force stopped, waited for the Germans to do something, and, when they didn't, trailed home. From the Allied point of view, the attempted deception was disappointing in the extreme, not to mention downright humiliating. It would later emerge that, instead of reinforcing their defences in light of a perceived threat, the Germans had actually reduced their troop numbers in the run-up to the mock invasion, apparently convinced that there were still insufficient troops in Britain for a full-scale invasion. Garbo scrambled to cover his back with a message to his German handler. "It appears the operation has been suspended. Troops surprised and disappointed." Cockade was a cock-up, but the double-crossed team could extract some crumbs of comfort. Popoff seemed even more firmly in favour with his German bosses, and Garbo's credibility was actually reinforced by the farce. "Your activity and that of your informants gave us a perfect idea of what is taking place over there," enthused Kuhlenthal, who was becoming infected by Garbo's rococo prose style. "These reports, as you can imagine, have an incalculable value, and for this reason I beg of you to proceed with the greatest care, so as not to endanger in these momentous times either yourself or your organization." Messages marked urgent were being relayed from the Garbo network to Berlin in under an hour. There can be no doubt of the high standing which Garbo enjoys with his masters, Johnny Bevan told Tar Robertson. "Garbo will have a very important role to play in the future." Some useful lessons were learned from the failed plan. Any future deception would have to involve every branch of the military, to the fullest extent, on a far wider scale. No fake invasion would be believed unless a real one was taking place at the same time. The double-cross players would have to up their game. Despite the disappointment, Masterman eagerly looked forward to the day when we should take part in the great final deception. The episode also instilled fresh confidence in Tar Robertson, along with a profound, but not entirely helpful, belief in the actual uses that pigeons can be put to from the point of view of espionage. 12. Discovered treasure. Kenneth Benton was, formally speaking, His Majesty's passport control officer in Madrid, in charge of visas, immigration, and customs formalities. In reality, he worked for MI6, recruiting agents and potential double agents, and, with his wife Peggy, also an MI6 officer, organizing a rich range of skullduggery to confound German espionage in the Iberian Peninsula. His opposite number in Madrid, Karl Erich Kühlenthal, considered him a sly fox, a description that Benton had read in most secret sources and found rather flattering. At 10:30 on the morning of July 17, 1943, Benton's secretary, Molly Gillard, rang through to say that there was someone in the embassy reception area demanding an urgent interview to sort out a visa. Moments later, a rather attractive woman of about 30 was ushered into his office, carrying a small white dog. The visitor perched on a chair with a creaking wicker back, the dog on her knee. "My name is Benton," said Benton. "If what I understood is correct, you wish to go to England to rejoin your family?" "Not exactly," said the young woman. "I'm going there to spy." In good English, Lily Sergeyev described her recruitment in Paris by Major Emil Kliman as Agent Solange, her training in the use of a wireless and secret ink, and her spying mission to Britain. She now wished to swap sides. They sized each other up. Lily saw a classic example of the Englishman, young, tall and slim, with a long narrow head and a straight brow with thinning red hair. Benton saw a typical Frenchwoman, made up and dressed to kill, with a self-dramatizing manner, but clearly intelligent. He wondered whether she might be, first and foremost, a self-server. During pauses in the conversation, she whispered remarks, in Russian, to her dog. Lily explained that, as instructed by Kliman, she had made contact with an Abwehr agent in Madrid, a man she knew only as Hans. Kliman himself had promised to bring a wireless to Madrid. He was late. Benton told Lily to report back to Hans and tell him that the British authorities had agreed to issue a visa, but the process might take several weeks. She should then wait for Kliman to arrive. That afternoon, Benton sent a coded telegram to London, describing his meeting with Lily Sergeyev and asking whether MI5 might have any use for her. He himself was doubtful. Benton's doubts were shared by John Masterman. "I should be very cautious about agreeing that she should become a double agent working for us," he wrote. "She ought to be thoroughly interrogated and a full account obtained of her activities before we decide we can use her." MI5 began a background check, interviewing people in Britain who knew Lily. "She has respectable friends and relatives," noted Tarr, "but these offered a contradictory picture of her loyalties." Virginia Hall, an American SOE agent who had known the Sergeyevs in Paris before the war, said she suspected that Lily was pro-German. Anthony Blunt, who also knew her slightly, described Lily as a white Russian with slightly left views, which was rich coming from him. Her cousin, Dr. Elizabeth Hill, who lived in Cambridge, was perfectly sure that Lily was pro-Allied in her sympathies and thought her something of an adventuress, but an exceedingly clever girl. The person assigned to investigate Lily Sergeyev was Mary Shearer, the latest addition to Tarr's team and the only woman case officer in B1A, though she was denied full officer status. Mary Corrie Shearer was 29, robust and ambitious, with a sharp sense of humour, often at other people's expense. She had joined MI5 as a secretary in 1938 and spent the first part of the war in the counter-sabotage section and working in New York for British Security Coordination, the clandestine arm of MI6, MI5, and SOE that sought to bring America into the war by means of propaganda, blackmail, and espionage. A child of the Indian Raj and the daughter of a brigadier, Mary was military in bearing and often wore a red jacket with epaulets, which she thought made her look like a general. She walked with a long martial stride, swinging her arms and humming little songs to herself when she thought no one could hear. In a male world, she assumed a carapace of toughness, smoking filterless Kent cigarettes and holding her gin as well as the next man. Mary was someone you did not want to cross, and was not quick to forgive any misdoings. But there was also a gentleness to her, and a resolute sense of purpose. After conducting the background check on Lily Sergeyev, Shearer concluded, "She appears to be a character well suited to becoming a double agent." Mary Shearer had a great deal of character, according to Benton, and not for the last time she stood up to her skeptical male bosses, insisting that a woman double agent, equipped with her own wireless and a gullible German handler, would be highly valuable in the run-up to the Allied invasion of Northwest Europe. Mary gave her the codename Treasure. After nearly 2 months in Madrid, Lily was becoming oppressed by a city full of menace and intrigue, a place where everyone is plotting, betraying, bribing or selling themselves. She urged Hans, her Abwehr contact, to tell Kleeman to come quickly. Still, he did not appear. "I have got very good at lying," she wrote in her diary. "I am beginning to feel the nervous strain of this double game, this constant change of personality without any let-up when I can be myself again." The only creature she could trust was her dog. Lily wrote to her sister, "The heat in Madrid is torrid. Bab sleeps blissfully on his back with 4 feet in the air and his tongue hanging out. I have just been talking to him about you. He opened one eye and raised an ear. That means he remembers." She arranged another meeting with Benton, who told her she had done extremely well. "We know a certain amount about Major Kleeman," he explained. "He's an important man in German intelligence, quite a formidable figure, in fact. I have the impression that you underestimate him. He has his weaknesses, certainly. You think him a little absurd because he is always late for appointments. If he finds out that you've double-crossed him, he won't be late for the next rendezvous, I can promise you." Finally, word came from Hans that Kleeman was on his way and would meet her at the Café Bacanique. When he eventually arrived, the dog jumped up to greet him. "Babs licks his face while he continues to waggle his tail and whole body." Lily felt moved by the sight of her dog and her German spymaster so pleased to see each other. "I look at them and think, at last, something genuine." Kleeman was excited by the way Lily's mission was progressing. He preened and ordered a steady stream of drinks. "It will be quite something for me to have set up an agent and actually get the same agent into England. It's incredible. It looks as if it's going to work." Kleeman, usually so lethargic, was all business. He planned to provide her with a radio set hidden inside a gramophone, with operating instructions written on a microdot concealed in the case. In order to read it, she would need to buy a small microscope. She should pretend to be interested in microbes. Indeed, she should carry a book with her as cover. He recommended The Microbe Hunters by Paul de Kreif. Lily declined to say that she thought this was a ridiculously overcomplicated plan. By now quite drunk, Kleeman was enjoying his role, though Lily could sense that he had something else on his mind. He suddenly grew pensive and gazed thoughtfully at the space in front of him, sighing deeply. "Anything wrong?" Lily asked, knowing that the conversation was about to turn to his favorite subject, Yvonne Delidaise, his mistress. Kleeman buried his face in his hands. "You must think me ridiculous. Maybe I am. She is young and pretty, gay and witty. And I? Look at me. A married man of 46. The German spymaster ordered another bottle of wine and poured his heart out. Yvonne had spent May in Madrid, at the Ritz, he said. After she returned to Paris, she was no longer the same toward him. Something must have happened while she was here, and he wanted Lily's help to find out what. With a fierce twinge of irritation, Lily understood that Kleeman had come to Spain with an ulterior motive that had nothing to do with her, and everything to do with his love life. Like most jealous lovers, he had already fixed on the rival he believed Yvonne to have been seeing in Madrid, Edgar Espirito Santo. He's a Portuguese, a very wealthy banker. He used to see a lot of Yvonne. He's a lady killer. Yvonne amused him. She is jolly and witty, but Yvonne doesn't mean a thing to him. I think she met him here. He always stops at the Ritz, and I want to know if he was there at the same time as Yvonne. I must know if she has been carrying on with that damned Espirito Santo.
and if she has made a fool of me. Then what? Then I shall ask for a transfer to the Russian front. But what do you want me to do?
She could make inquiries, suggested Kliman, and see if the banker had been staying at the Ritz when Yvonne was in Madrid. Lily had come to Spain as a German spy, not as a freelance private detective for a middle-aged married man besotted with a younger woman. She was outraged.
Major Kliman, I don't care a hang about your ridiculous affairs, Lily railed. In a few days, I shall be in England and you will be in Paris. I shall probably never see you again. Why should I care whether Yvonne is deceiving you or not?
Kliman was pleading and plastered. She left him in the café. The next day, she related this bizarre conversation to Benton, who reported back to MI5. Kliman appears to be extremely pleased with her progress and pathologically jealous of his mistress, he wrote. Two discoveries that, in combination, rendered him uniquely vulnerable. Lily was Kliman's only spy. If she now became a prop for his frail sexual ego, then he would be even more in her debt, and even easier to manipulate. Benton advised her to report back to the Major that the object of Kliman's jealousy was not at the Ritz, or even in Madrid, in May. The MI6 officer then made his own inquiries, which suggested that Yvonne probably had been carrying on with the Portuguese banker. There was no sense in telling Kliman that. Whatever the truth may be, the report must prove that Yvonne is faithful to him. Now that we know all about Major Kliman, we want him to stay in the job. We must make quite sure he doesn't get sent to the Russian front. Kliman was delighted with Lily's purely fictitious but reassuring report, affirming Yvonne's fidelity. Predictably, he had failed to find her a wireless set, but insisted he would be able to get one passed to her in Britain by a Spaniard, who was under great obligation to Kliman's friends. MI5 would later conclude that this must have been a reference to Ángel Alcázar de Velasco, the press attaché at the Spanish embassy and a known German agent. He then handed over two pellets of ink for secret writing, and a long questionnaire clearly aimed at discovering the Allies' invasion plans, which he told her to memorize and then destroy. What view is taken in authoritative English circles of landing preparations? Where are the barracks placed in coastal towns? Kliman wanted information on uniforms and troop movements, stoppage of leave, armaments production, and much more. Lily and British intelligence seemed to have Kliman exactly where they wanted him. She was the personification of his hopes, the evidence of his subtlety, his courage, and his flair. Only once did the conversation take a more sinister turn, when Kliman, with studied nonchalance, observed that after her abrupt departure from Paris, the Gestapo had put her parents' flat under surveillance. Lily did not like the sense of threat in that remark, and told him that if any harm came to her parents while she was away, he would find her working for the other side against him. It was half a joke, but Kliman's response was immediate, sharp, and entirely without humour. Naturally, should she double-cross him, she must consider that the lives of her parents were at stake. Kliman now reached into a pocket with an air of great munificence and handed Agent Solange a small package wrapped in tissue. Inside was a diamond solitaire ring and a 2-inch brooch in the shape of a branch with 5 small diamonds representing blossoms. The ring had cost 95,000 francs in Paris, he said, and the brooch 39,000 Portuguese escudos. In England, she could sell the jewellery and say it had belonged to her grandmother. To this he added a pile of 7,000 Spanish pesetas, with an additional 2,000 pesetas as a bonus for setting his mind at rest about Yvonne's visit to Spain, a token of thanks for her help and sympathy. Dinner over, Kliman climbed into a taxi in the Plaza del Callao and drove off with a cheery wave. He was a happy man. His mistress was faithful, his bosses were pleased, and his star agent was now about to help win the war for Germany. That night, Lily wrote in her diary, "He has gone. He hasn't found out anything. And now, England." Kenneth Benton of MI6 had grown to like Lily. He liked her still more when she reappeared in his office with Babs in tow and handed over Kliman's questionnaire, proof of mounting German anxiety over the coming invasion. She was dressed to the nines, having spent all the Spanish cash from Kliman on clothes,
I was getting to know her and felt she had a good feeling for the job. Everything was in order for her onward travel to Lisbon. Then she exploded her landmine.
"Mr. Benton," said Lily, "I have one more request. I have worked for you. I will continue to work for you. I don't ask for any payment. But I have one favor to ask. I want to keep Babs with me."
Benton was taken aback. It wasn't possible. It wouldn't be allowed. There were quarantine laws.
"That's exactly it. I want to skip quarantine," Lily explained. "Babs has been vaccinated. I've got his anti-rabies certificate, and there is no danger. It's the only thing I ask for, but I do insist on it."
British laws preventing dogs from entering the country until declared disease-free were some of the oldest and silliest in the statute book, maintained long after science and technology had effectively removed the rabies threat. This strange animal-based xenophobia probably had something to do with Britain being an island. Benton was happy to break every law in the book to help win the war, but he was not about to break the sacrosanct quarantine laws. He prevaricated.
"I'll see what I can do."
But Lily would not be fobbed off. She would not leave without Babs.
"If my work is important, it is worth this exemption. If it isn't worth that, then it isn't worth my going to England. To you, it's just a dog, but to me, it's Babs, and worth more than £1 million. Just tell your people in London that."
She was working herself up into one of her rages.
"Why can't I go by Gibraltar?"
"Even if you did, you would have to leave the dog in quarantine for 6 months. In fact, I'm not even sure they would allow that."
"You can persuade them. After all, I'm going to be an important double agent."
"I cannot persuade them. This is wartime, Lily."
"Then I will refuse to go. I will stay here in Spain. I won't leave my poor little Babs."
Desperate for the interview to end, Benton offered to find a kind owner for Babs. It was wartime. She had to make sacrifices. Lily whispered angrily in Russian to her dog before turning back to Benton.
"You shall not have him. He knows nothing about your war. All he wants is to be with me."
Benton, who rather liked dogs, told her he would do his best, though he knew it was going to be impossible to get that wretched dog into Britain without passing through quarantine. He had resorted to a very English sort of temporizing, a commitment to do what he could, when he planned to do very little, and believed that nothing could be done. But Lily had heard something very different. She had heard an Englishman promise to get her dog into Britain. That misunderstanding would have the most profound ramifications. Benton asked London what to do about Lily's dog. "Get her to Gibraltar, then leave it to Gibraltar colleagues to sort out," came the reply. Benton reported back to Lily. "My Gibraltar colleagues might be able to find a way of smuggling Babs to Britain, perhaps by sea." In reality, this had already been ruled out by the MI6 officer on the island. On October 7, 1943, Lily Sergeyev, travelling under an alias, arrived in Gibraltar under escort with her dog. Benton did not fail to notice the suspicious looks she gave him as they said goodbye. Sure enough, when she reached Gibraltar, the customs officer insisted she surrender the dog.
"I picked up Babs and handed him over,"
Lily wrote in her diary. The difficult moment had arrived. But their separation, she assured herself, would be temporary. She had Benton's promise. The next day, an MI6 officer in plain clothes, who introduced himself as O'Shagar, came to see Agent Treasure at the hotel. "From now on, you have nothing to worry about. We will take charge of everything," he told her. Lily pressed him about Babs and
Mr. Benton's promise to arrange for his transport and to make sure that he wouldn't have to go into quarantine.
O'Shagar replied that they'd see to that too. That night, at the hotel bar, she met a friendly American pilot, Lieutenant Kenneth Larson, who liked dogs.
"Why don't you send him to London with one of our pilots? They don't have to go through customs or any controls at all," he said. "Would you like me to fix it up for you?"
The next morning, she reported the conversation to O'Shagar, pointing out that this arrangement would save an awful lot of bother and red tape. But she wanted to promise that if the American failed to deliver Babs to Britain, then MI6 would find a way to do so.
"You have my word," said O'Shagar.
That, at least, was how Lily remembered the conversation. By some immutable law of travel, luggage always lets you down when you are in the greatest haste. Lily was about to board the flight for England when the clasp on her suitcase gave way, spilling its contents everywhere. Oshagar gathered up her scattered belongings, stuffed them in the broken suitcase, and promised to get it repaired and sent over on the next flight. Lily ran for the plane. A few hours later, Dorothy Tremaine landed at Bristol Airport. The policewoman detailed to collect her had been told to look out for a woman with a small white dog and a large record player. She had no gramophone and no dog. She also had no suitcase. But she was in no doubt that the French woman complaining loudly in the arrivals hall must be Lily Sergeyev. Treasure had finally been smuggled into Britain, bringing with her, in Masterman's words, a rich dowry, the confidence of the Germans. Back in Madrid, Kenneth Benton of MI6 suffered a feeling of guilt when he learned that Lily had flown to England, leaving her beloved dog behind in Gibraltar. But then he reflected, after all, it was wartime, and sacrifices, as I had told her, had to be made by people and consciences alike. Besides, Benton had other things on his mind. He was about to reel in an even bigger fish, an officer within the Abwehr itself. 13. The Walk-In. On September 14, 1943, Dushko Popov flew back to Britain and was immediately taken to Clock House, the cottage rented by MI5, for a debriefing by Tar Robertson and Ian Wilson. Both were in a state of high excitement to see what Tricycle had brought back from Lisbon. Solemnly, Popov opened the diplomatic bag provided by von Karstorff. "First of all, a very large number of silk stockings fell out," wrote Wilson. "These were followed by a radio transmitter, a Leica camera, and 6 rolls of film, ingredients for making secret ink, $2,000 and £2,500 in cash, and yet more questionnaires. This complete spy kit was proof enough of German faith in Popov, but additional reassurance came from most secret sources, which, as Wilson reported, make it clear that Tricycle's reports to us are accurate, that for the most part the Germans still believe him, and that those members of the Abwehr who have reason to doubt him are so corrupt or so afraid of losing their jobs by disclosing awkward facts that they are doing all they can to support him. Popov explained that he had met up once again with Johnny Jebsen and was now absolutely sure that his friend knew he was a double agent. The way he talks to me and his whole behavior shows this very clearly. Jebsen had been even more candid than before, talking of that idiot Hitler and speaking with a funny smile in his eyes that left Popov in no doubt that he knew every word he said would be relayed straight back to the Allies. Jebsen's enemies in Berlin were machinating against him, he said, and the Gestapo was circling. But the part of Popov's report that really made his listeners sit up was Jebsen's account of some new invention causing great excitement in Berlin, a multiple rocket device with the same effect as a 2,000-kilo bomb. Robertson immediately sent a memo to the 20 committee informing the board of this most alarming information from Jebsen, who seemed to be, for the first time, acting as a conscious informant. Popov did not say explicitly that he had advised his friend to go to the British and offer himself as a double agent, but he almost certainly had. A full report was sent to Churchill. Tricycle has just returned from a visit to Lisbon, where he has been in contact with members of the German Secret Service. He gained the impression that they no longer hope to win the war and expect it to be over shortly. He learnt from his spymaster, who is also a close personal friend, that the latter believes in the existence of a rocket gun for shelling London. The spymaster added that the raids on Germany had delayed the production of the gun by about 2 months, but that it should be in action by December, and Tricycle would be well advised to leave London before then. The Germans further told Tricycle that they are well informed about the British order of battle. The Germans said that they had practically no agents in the USA, but that they had 10 or 12 in the UK. This corresponds to those under our control. They also told him the story of a major in the German Secret Service in Berlin who had suggested that the agents in England were under British control, but was sacked for this suggestion within 24 hours. The rocket gun
was the V-1, the flying bomb being developed in Germany in order to bombard Britain into submission. Jepsen's information corroborated what was already known about the new weapon, while his description of the Germans' faith in their British spy network underlined Tarr's claim to control the whole thing. Any German intelligence officer who dared suggest the spies were false was regarded as a heretic and liable to be fired. The final element in Popov's Lisbon Hall was a plan that had been stewing for some time, a way to smuggle additional double agents into Britain with German help. With MI5's approval, Popov had spun von Karstorff an ingenious tale. Since numerous Yugoslavs were anxious to get to Britain, why not introduce some secret Nazi spies among the genuine refugees? Popov's older brother, Ivo, living in Belgrade, could select potential candidates. Ivo was held in high regard by the Germans, who saw him as a keen and dedicated collaborator, so highly trusted that he had been issued travel papers, a Wehrmacht uniform, and the rank of Sonderführer, specialist leader. Ivo Popov would select recruits who, with German assistance, would be smuggled into Britain via Spain as refugees. Once they arrived in Britain, the younger Popov brother would take them in hand and add them to his spy network. Von Karstorff leaped at the idea, and on July 23rd sent a message to Berlin describing Popov's plan for infiltrating spies into Britain. "I consider this plan a good one," he wrote. "I still consider Ivan as reliable, if kept under supervision." What von Karstorff did not know was that Ivo Popov, like his brother, was working for the other side and had already been recruited by British intelligence as Agent Dreadnought. Instead of choosing Nazi sympathizers for the slipping-out operation, he would select his own anti-Nazi collaborators who had been briefed to play the part. At the other end, Popov, Robertson, and the Double Cross Committee would be waiting to welcome them. Every link of the chain was false. Instead of introducing keen new spies into Britain, the Germans would be helping to recruit, train, finance, and transport a stream of ready-made double agents, pre-cooked and ready to serve. The first agent to be slipped out in this way was the Marquis Frano de Bona, an aristocratic Yugoslavian naval officer and a friend and former carousing partner of Dusko Popov. At Ivo's instigation, de Bona was recruited by the Abwehr, trained as a wireless operator, and slipped into Spain. While waiting for his transfer to London as a refugee, the Marquis took up residence in a Madrid brothel, where he spent 4 days and nights, finally emerging exhausted and happy, but with a nasty dose of venereal crabs. On arrival in Britain, he moved into Clock House with Popov and became a double agent, the wireless operator for the Tricycle Network. No longer would Popov and his sub-agents have to rely on secret writing to communicate with Germany. Whether because of his long hair, licentiousness, or lice, the Marquis de Bona was awarded a most unflattering codename. He became Agent Freak. Intriguingly, Freak's briefing in Germany offered indications that elements within the Abwehr were ready to sue for peace. Churchill read of de Bona's arrival. His main mission, it appears, was to contact Englishmen in high places and to impress upon them very strongly the view that Germany is open to approaches from this country with a view to stemming the flow of communism across the continent of Europe, and for this purpose, they required the assistance of the British. The core of his instructions was that Germany was not to be forced to capitulate, but should be granted terms by this country to enable her to maintain a barrier in Eastern Europe against the communist peril. It was emphasized that Germany was willing, in order to obtain these terms, to get rid of Hitler, to introduce a democratic form of government acceptable to the English and Americans, and withdraw from all occupied territory. This was the essence of the anti-Nazi resistance: to oust Hitler, ally with the West, defeat the Bolsheviks, and salvage some German pride. Anthony Blunt certainly passed this report to the Soviets, doubtless compounding Stalin's suspicions that the British and Americans might make peace with Germany and then turn on the Soviet Union. Churchill believed that the war could only end with Germany's unconditional surrender, but de Bona brought hard evidence that Abwehr officers were now actively maneuvering to oust the Führer. Riven with conspiracy, double-crossed from within, under attack from its rivals, German military intelligence was starting to implode. Kenneth Benton made his way upstairs in the British Embassy in Madrid to a small attic room usually used as a bedroom for escaped POWs. There he found a young man who was chain-smoking and looking rather sweaty and apprehensive. The man rose, shook hands, and spoke in perfect, accentless English. "I am an officer in the Abwehr, and I wish you to protect me from the Gestapo." Benton offered his guest a whiskey. The Abwehrman smiled rather charmingly, revealing nicotine-stained teeth. "Where I come from, we love whiskey, and I could certainly do with a drink right now." Sipping whiskey and soda in his well-cut suit and monocle, he might have been an Englishman. He wore a very small blonde moustache and fiddled restlessly, lighting one cigarette from another. "My name is Johnny Yepsen," he said. "I suppose you are Mr. Benton." The MI6 man was taken aback. His real name was supposed to be a closely guarded secret, even within the embassy. Yepsen smiled again. "You're in trouble?" asked Benton. "The Gestapo are on my tail because I made a report on their dealings in forged banknotes."
"Have they followed you here?"
"No, I shook them off."
Yepsen had every reason to be agitated. Not only was the Gestapo closing in, but he had learned that Kammler, the Abwehr official in Lisbon skimming Popov's pay, had denounced him to the bosses in Berlin. Yepsen feared that his hotel room in Lisbon might have been bugged and his indiscreet conversations with Popov overheard. His supporters within the Abwehr had advised him to stay away from Germany. He might need an escape route. They talked for 2 hours, and as Yepsen relaxed, he became ever more informative and opinionated, revealing the identities of senior Abwehr officers in Spain and their special fields of interest, his role as a freelance agent recruiter, and sinking German morale. "There is hardly a soul any more in Germany who believes in victory. Probably the only man who really does is Hitler." He drank more whiskey and cracked dark jokes. During an air raid, Hitler, Goering, Goebbels, and Himmler took refuge in the same air raid shelter. The shelter received a direct hit. Who was saved? Germany. He described again the secret weapon being built in Germany, which would spread terror throughout the whole of the south of England. Yepsen said he did not know any details about the mystery weapon, but could find out more. "I'm giving you a lot of information, aren't I?" he remarked with a grin. "Well, it'll be up to you to help me in return." Yepsen was ready to cut a deal. If the Gestapo came after him, he wanted the British to get him out, quickly. In return, he would reveal everything he knew. Benton knew that smuggling Yepsen back to Britain from Spain would be simple enough, but the consequences of such a move were unpredictable. When the Abwehr discovered Yepsen's defection, it would assume he had revealed all, and anyone associated with him would immediately become suspect. Yepsen had thought of a solution. He would leave a fake suicide note to cover his sudden disappearance, in which he would write, "I shall take poison and swim far out into the sea. It may be days before my corpse is washed up, and it will then be no longer recognizable." It is hard to imagine even the most idiotic Abwehr officer falling for such an obvious ruse. MI5 would later dismiss Yepsen's suicide plot as a piece of extreme foolishness brought on by excessive nervous strain. Benton felt drawn to Yepsen. The spy spoke warmly of his love for England, his wish to study at Oxford after the war, his friendship with P.G. Woodhouse, and his bossy English secretary, Mabel Harbottle, who refused to type letters that might undermine the Allied war effort. He was an interesting and well-educated man, and very good company, thought Benton, but also worldly, cynical, and dissolute. He had a great liking for pornographic films, and admitted that one of the reasons why he came so frequently to Madrid was the existence of 2 clandestine Madrid cinemas which specialized in this kind of film. He made no secret of his fears and no claims to courage. With a visible shudder, he described the Ableger Commandos, a trained hijack team skilled in seizing a wanted man and smuggling him back across the frontiers without arousing suspicion. Even in neutral Spain, he might be kidnapped at any time and taken back to Germany, a prospect that terrified him.
Benton advised Jebsen to spend that night at the embassy. It is in your interest. By tomorrow I'll have a safe house. Over a last nightcap, Benton asked his new recruit if there were other Abwehr officers who might be willing to defect. Jebsen replied, I'm sure some of them have been turned, and I know one Abwehr agent, a man I recruited myself, who has either been turned already or would go over to your side at the drop of a hat. Who is that?
Dusan Popov,
Jebsen answered. He's a prolific agent, run from both Berlin and Lisbon. Jebsen had recruited Popov into the Abwehr. Popov, once turned, had urged the British to recruit Jebsen. Now Jebsen, in the process of being turned, urged the British to recruit Popov. He was being deliberately disingenuous. Jebsen knew by now, and probably had known from the beginning, that Popov was working for the British. Henceforth, they would be working together. Benton sat up late, drafting a long report to London about Jebsen, whom he codenamed Artist. The reply said, Artist is telling you the truth. He is a Forscher, and well known to us. This contact has great potential value. Use utmost caution. Jebsen told him he would remain in Spain for the time being, see what developed, and keep in touch. I was very sorry to part with Artist, Benton later wrote. Jebsen was plainly being honest about his espionage activities, if not his financial dealings. Artist told me that he suspected the Gestapo of lining their pockets with forged British banknotes, but I was never quite sure it was not the other way around. With Jebsen, it was always tricky to work out which way round the truth lay. Lily Sergeyev's first moments on British soil could not have been more inauspicious. She had been told not to answer questions until she was interrogated. You won't have to open your mouth from here to London, Oshagar had told her as she left Gibraltar. Mary Shearer had sent instructions that she should be dealt with at the airport in an absolutely normal manner, since Lily was particularly anxious that as few people as possible should know about her case, as she has a family still in Paris. The very first official she encountered was an immigration officer named Gold, fat, with big ears, and a stickler for the rules. Gold asked her name. She refused to answer. He asked where she was born. Lily said nothing. Finally, in what was later admitted to be a rather ill-advised attempt to make her feel at ease, Gold remarked, It's all right. You needn't worry. We know all about you. The Germans have sent you here. Lily exploded. She had been in Britain less than an hour, and already some lumpen official, with outsize ears, was telling her that everybody knew her secret. Lily was still shouting when a severe-looking policewoman appeared, saying she had been sent to escort Miss Tremaine to London. She was driven to a house in Balham, through the pouring rain, and put to bed by a motherly woman calling herself Mrs. Maud. The next morning, after a deep and exhausted night's sleep and a breakfast of porridge, she was ushered into a second-floor room to find a woman in a red suit sitting on the edge of a chair, her arms folded, chin resting on her hands. Mary Shearer appraised Agent Treasure coolly, through slightly slanted greenish eyes. For a few moments neither spoke. Lily then perched on the sofa and reeled off her story. Mary took notes, saying little. After an hour, she stood up. You can be extremely useful to us, and the opening you provide may be of vital importance. We will be delighted to work with you, but you must realize the gravity of the situation. By helping the British, you will be working for France, for her liberation. She escorted Lily to a waiting car. Lily was driven to flat 19, Rugby Mansions in Kensington, and introduced to Maritza, a Yugoslavian woman who would be her housekeeper, Mary explained. She did not explain that the flat was an MI5 safe house under surveillance. The phone was bugged, the post monitored, and Maritza Mihailovich was herself a double agent, codenamed The Snark, after the Lewis Carroll nonsense poem The Hunting of the Snark. Since Carroll himself could not explain what a snark was, this may be one code name with no relevance whatsoever to its subject. A domestic servant, she had been recruited by the Abwehr in Yugoslavia and arrived in England as a refugee in 1941. B1A had run her as a double agent for a time,
but for unknown reasons, the Germans had lost interest in her, and since 1943 she had worked for MI5 as a cleaner and as a spy. The Snark would be keeping a close eye on treasure. Tar Robertson soon arrived, exuding bonhomie. "So you are here at last. Let me congratulate you on your work. It's a great success. Now you must relax, forget your fears and uncertainty. Nothing more can happen to you. You are among friends." Lily made no reply. She was fairly impervious to English charm. Robertson ploughed on. "We look on you as a trump card. There is no doubt the German intelligence people have complete confidence in you, so we are in a unique position to feed them false information. We can pull off what is known in the trade as an intoxication." With Mary Shearer's help, Tar explained, Lily would write her own letters. "I want you yourself to draft all the messages," said Tar. "If you think that any of the stuff we want to send will seem unlikely to the Germans, you mustn't hesitate to say so. The possibilities open to us are so precious that we must not take even the smallest risk." For the next 4 hours, she went through her story yet again. She drew a map of Madrid, showing where she had met her German contacts, and even sketched portraits of Yvonne Delides and Emil Kliemann. "That only leaves the financial question," said Tar, beaming. "We'll take over the money and jewellery and give you £50 a month, and 10% of anything else they send. Is that all right?" Lily nodded, but reflected that the Germans had offered her £250 a month. "I am not doing this for the money," she told her diary, "but I am a little surprised." The brooch and diamond ring were locked in the B1A safe, but not before MI5 had valued them and found the jewellery was worth just £100. Rather a far cry from the £400 that Kliemann thought she would get. The arrival of this promising new double agent was relayed to Churchill. "A French citizen of Russian origin, she has lived most of her life in Paris, where she occupied herself with journalism, and at one time gained a considerable reputation as an artist. Through a fellow journalist, a German whom she had known before the war, Treasure gained her first introduction to the German Secret Service. It was a long time before Treasure was able to persuade her German masters to send her to this country. She has had extensive training in wireless transmission and in secret ink writing. She did not bring a wireless set with her, but was assured that arrangements had been made for one to be sent. Anthony Blunt had made a special request to be informed when Treasure arrives. News of Lily's arrival was certainly relayed to the Kremlin. Mary Shearer was far too English to show it, but she was pleased with Lily and already had the very strong conviction that this, her first double agent, was going to be a success, come what might. Kim Philby, her colleague in MI6, remarked darkly, "Poor girl, she's in for a disappointment. Never trust a Tsarist emigre." Lily glumly appraised her new home, the flat with its large ill-furnished rooms, clean and impersonal, like the rooms of a hotel. She went for a walk, Maritza hovering in attendance. The street was bleak and gloomy, and Rugby Mansions, a plain-fronted house with neither imagination nor ornament, as sour as an old spinster suffering from jaundice. She had imagined a London ferociously at war. This place was grey, damp and foggy. Lily thought of herself as a bird of colour, an artist, a child of bright adventure. This was not her world. "What strikes me is the shabby appearance of everyone in the street. Worn-out overcoats, shiny sleeves, dowdy clothes. In the shop windows the dresses are straight, without facing, lapels, or belt. Everything remotely frivolous has been pitilessly sacrificed." Her new handlers seemed detached and distant. Mary Shearer was a puzzle. "I still cannot quite place her. Is she my jailer, or nursery governess, or what?" she wrote. "I don't even know what she feels about me, though I suppose this really doesn't matter very much." Lowering her spirits still further was the nagging and growing pain in her kidneys, a recurrence of her old malady. Lily missed Paris, stylish even under Nazi occupation. She missed the excitement of playing one side off against the other. She even missed Kliemann. But most of all, she missed Babs. 14.
A time for fortitude. The D-Day deception plan went through many versions and many names in the months leading up to June 1944. Operation Yael, named after the Old Testament heroine who nailed her sleeping enemy's head to the floor with a tent peg, aimed to persuade the Germans there would be no invasion in 1944. Then came Torrent, or Appendix Y, intended to convince them that Calais was the sole target. The plan for Operation Bodyguard, combining elements of the earlier plans, was finally completed by Johnny Bevan, haggard with sleeplessness, just before Christmas 1943. Bodyguard was worldwide in scope and vaulting in ambition. Its aims were multiple: to tie down German troops in the Mediterranean with the bogus threat of assaults on the Dalmatian and Greek coasts, to dissipate German strength by suggesting that additional attacks might be made in northwest Italy, Bulgaria, Denmark, and, most important, Norway, to implant the idea that the bombing of Germany would take precedence over land-based assaults, and to make the Germans believe, for as long as possible, that no cross-channel attack could take place until late summer. Bodyguard's aim was to baffle and bemuse, to keep German troops away from where they would most be needed, hold them down where they could do the least harm, and lure them away from France and the Eastern Front and toward Italy, the Balkans, Greece, and Scandinavia. Bodyguard would be implemented in various theatres of war, but its most important element by far was the plan to mislead Hitler over the planned Normandy landings. The choice of codename for this particular operation, the crux of Bodyguard, was much debated. Churchill had given instructions that no code name should be selected that might seem flippant in retrospect, or give a hint of the individual or action involved. But he also disliked code names that meant nothing at all, which is why the original choice, Messpot, was rejected. Also vetoed were Bulldog, Swordhilt, Axehead, Tempest, and, obscurely, Lignite. Finally, a name was selected that seemed to evoke the resolution required to pull it off: Operation Fortitude. A vast secret army set to work on Operation Fortitude, fabricating physical deception, including dummy landing craft and rubber tanks at key points, and technical deception in the form of great waves of radio traffic, a blizzard of electric noise, mimicking great armies training and assembling where none existed. British diplomats dropped misleading hints at cocktail parties to be overheard by the eavesdroppers and channeled back to Germany. Conspicuously large orders were made for Michelin Map 51, a map of the Pas-de-Calais area. The French resistance, special operations executive agents, saboteur and guerrilla teams, MI6, the code breakers at Bletchley, secret scientists, and camouflage engineers would each play a part in this great, sprawling, multifaceted deception campaign. But at its core was Tar Robertson's tiny team of double agents, telling lies to their spy masters in secret writing, by radio, and to their faces, forging a shield of deceit that would guard the soldiers, if it worked, onto the beaches of Normandy. Many played a part in planning Operation Fortitude, but three principal architects of the deception plan stand out: Colonel Johnny Bevan, the head of the London Controlling Section; Major Roger Fleetwood Hesketh, the leading intelligence officer within the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, SHEF, whose task it was to merge military planning and deception; and Colonel David Strangeways, the head of General Montgomery's Deception Section. Christopher Harmer of B1A would act as liaison between the headquarters of the Expeditionary Force and the Double Cross team. These were very different men. Fleetwood Hesketh, a barrister with one of the best claret cellars in England, was charming and witty, with a fine sense of the absurd. Harmer described him as a most tidy and meticulous worker, but essentially a scorer rather than a player. Strangeways, a hard-driving infantryman, was impossible and insufferable, according to Harmer, but frequently right and occasionally inspired. Bevan, overworked and under stress, was liable to volcanic eruptions of temper, always followed by heartfelt apology. Their roles were often ill-defined and overlapping. Tempers frayed and snapped. The rows were spectacular, but the extent of their collaboration was even more remarkable. Between them, these individuals would fashion and then implement the most ambitious deception campaign ever attempted. Operation Fortitude was revised over time. At one point, the acerbic Strangeways, in his own words, rewrote the thing entirely, igniting another furious argument, though his changes were finally accepted. In its final form, the plan had several interlinked aims. It sought to convince the Germans that the attack on Normandy, eventually scheduled for June, was merely diversionary, a ploy to draw off German forces before the main thrust of the invasion in the Pas-de-Calais around the middle of July. At the same time, it sought to lure the Germans into preparing for an attack on Norway, along with another landing in the area of Bordeaux. Crucially, the threat to the Pas-de-Calais would be maintained for as long as possible after the Normandy landings, to ensure that the Germans did not send a large body of troops south to repel the real invasion. The deception plan was divided in two. Fortitude North was the fake threat to Norway. Fortitude South would pose and maintain the threat to the Pas-de-Calais. In order for the plan to work, the Germans must be made to expect three separate invasions, a feint in Normandy and two major landings in Norway and the Pas-de-Calais, and therein lay a major hurdle. There were simply not enough soldiers in Britain to do what the planners wanted the Germans to believe they were about to do, so they invented them. It was Strangeways who came up with the idea of inventing an entire army in southeast England, poised to invade the northeast coast of France. This ghost army, supposedly stationed directly across the channel from the Pas-de-Calais, was dubbed the First United States Army Group, or FUSAG. Another fake force, the British Fourth Army, would be created in Scotland to keep German minds focused on a threat to Norway. These counterfeit armies would threaten bogus targets while living soldiers prepared to attack the real target, in Normandy. Masterman was itching for the game to start. "We had always expected," he wrote, "that at some one moment all the agents would be recklessly and gladly blown sky-high in carrying out the grand deception, and that this one great coup would bring our work to an end." There were voices of caution and some of skepticism, including the British Army representative on the 20 Committee, who insisted that the German General Staff will not move a single German division on an agent's report alone. Unless, of course, they discovered the agent was a double agent and the division was then moved in precisely the wrong direction. An agent who turned out not to be believed by the enemy might wreck the whole enterprise, or, even worse, his messages might be read in reverse, and the true target of the attack be exposed instead of revealed. There was every possibility the plan could backfire disastrously. Churchill and Roosevelt were kept fully apprised of the roles planned for the double agents in the deception, as was Stalin, both officially and secretly. The NKVD mole, Anthony Blunt, now promoted to major, was still burrowing deep into British intelligence, digging up every scrap of secret information he could find and shipping it all to Moscow. "I have managed to get myself in touch with Robertson, who runs the double agents," he told his Soviet handlers. "In this way I can usually get an idea of what is actually planned and what is being put across as cover. If there was an equivalent German mole within Soviet intelligence, then the entire deception would be blown. Or it might have been, had it not been for the paranoia ingrained into Soviet officialdom. Moscow did not believe what Blunt was telling them, because it was too good to be true. Having discovered that Britain was practicing an intricate double-cross operation on the Germans, the Soviets convinced themselves that they, too, must be victims of such a deception. According to the warped logic of the NKVD, the Cambridge Five, Blunt, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and John Cairncross, were sending such high-grade information that they must be double agents sending deliberate disinformation. And since the information from the Five tallied perfectly, this was further proof that they were in league. The chief exponent of this gymnastic exercise in doublethink was Colonel Elena Modrzyńskaya, a blonde, rotund, zealously conspiratorial NKVD officer responsible for assessing British intelligence. Her suspicion of Blunt and his fellow spies was based on the assumption, firmly held and quite wrong, that the British could not be so foolish as to allow former communists to occupy senior positions in the intelligence services. Therefore, Blunt and the others must have been working for the British from the beginning. A splendidly incompetent NKVD surveillance team was sent to gather evidence of the Cambridge spies making contact with their British handlers. Since Blunt worked inside MI5, this evidence of contact with British intelligence was not hard to find. As the D-Day deception was being crafted, Moscow sent a letter to its London spy chief, warning of a vast, organized deception by these British double agents. "Our task is to understand what disinformation our rivals are planting on us, since all the data from Blunt and the others indicated a double-cross operation." The irony that Moscow was only aware of the existence of the British double-cross system because Blunt had revealed it to them was entirely lost on Colonel Modrzyńskaya. But in the mirroring world of espionage, Blunt and Modrzyńskaya might actually end up supporting the deception. If Agent Tony was a double agent, then his false information should be read in reverse. If he indicated that Normandy was the real target and the Pas-de-Calais a decoy, then the Pas-de-Calais must be the real target and Normandy a feint. And if a German mole had penetrated Soviet intelligence, then that is the information he would be passing back to Berlin. In a nutshell, if the Germans believed that the Soviets thought the British were trying to make them believe something that was untrue, then the deception would still be on track. At the very least, Soviet suspicions would muddy the waters to an opacity beyond human penetration. By the end of 1943, wrote Masterman, the double-cross team was far more powerful and better equipped than it had ever been before. The double agents were reaching peak fitness. Tricycle, Popov, was beloved and admired by his German handlers, with Jebsen, the latest addition to the team, on hand to protect him. Garbo sat on Crespigny Road, Hendon, arguing with his wife and spinning ever more elaborate fantasies. Treasure was now in place, lonely and lovesick without her dog, but ready to start feeding misinformation back to Kleeman. Bronx, the socialite spy, was in regular contact with Germany. Even the excitable Brutus might soon be back in play if the Pole could be extracted from prison. The double-cross idea had always been based on lateral thinking without boundaries, a willingness to contemplate plans that others would dismiss as unworkable or, frankly, balmy. Flights of fantasy were integral to the system, which perhaps explains why, just as the D-Day deception plans were falling into place, the double-cross system suddenly took wing and soared into the surreal. Of all the strands in Operation Fortitude, none was quite so bizarre, so wholly unlikely, as the Great Pigeon Double-Cross, the first and only avian deception scheme ever attempted. Animal-based espionage and sabotage was all the rage among Allied plotters. SOE agents stuffed dead rats with explosives, and military zoologists explored the use of trained marine mammals for naval sabotage. In December 1943, Guy Liddell reported an American scheme for attacking Japan using thousands of exploding Mexican bats. These bats should be put into crates shipped to Seattle. Attached to the feet and wings of the bats were to be small incendiaries. The bats were to be released from an aeroplane near Tokyo, the idea being that they would fly down chimneys and that Tokyo would go up in flames. The idea never took off, but was taken seriously. "It sounds like a perfectly wild idea, but is worth looking into," said Roosevelt. People like Robertson and Walker flourished in that grey area between ingenuity and insanity. Early in 1944, our pigeon expert, as Robertson called Walker, approached B-1A with an audacious new plan. With D-Day approaching, and having failed to make much impact on enemy pigeons in Britain, because there weren't any, the unstoppable Flight Lieutenant Walker began to wonder if there were not some more offensive way of attacking the German pigeon service. He came up with the double-cross pigeon racket, a plan that might wipe out the enemy pigeon population at a stroke. Every German intelligence station in occupied France had a pigeon section. Moreover, collaborationist French pigeon fanciers were being recruited as stay-behind agents to harbour German homing pigeons, and then release them with intelligence from behind the lines in the event of a successful Allied invasion. Walker began to wonder whether Himmler's interest in pigeons and his taste for final solutions could be manipulated to Allied advantage. If the Germans could be fooled into believing that British spy pigeons had infiltrated their lofts, then it would throw suspicion on the entire German pigeon service. If they could no longer trust their own pigeons, they might kill the lot. In the winter of 1943, he presented MI5 with a top-secret memo laying out his pigeon contamination plan.